This is Nigel Uzi from CB On My Skin. My mom works at a software engineering firm in Philadelphia called Stratus. They have a strong commitment to diversity and inclusion. It's a really cool place, and I told one of the engineers, Seema, about my project. And I asked him two questions. How do you see yourself? And how do you fear others perceive you? It really got him thinking, and he shared it with the Stratus Idea team. Idea stands for Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Access. They spent a long time discussing how they see themselves and why their names are important and how they felt included or excluded from their communities, friends, or even families. My mom pulled me out of doing schoolwork to listen to part of it. They recorded the conversation, and I'm sharing it with you now.
Was that my cue? So, the question Nigel had posed to me was, how do I see myself? And this was on Friday, and I had to take the weekend to think about it. And while I was thinking about it, I realized I really didn't know who my sense of self was, because there were so many different versions. And once I posed that question to the chat, I realized I kind of saw myself as a perceptual sculpture, so a sculpture that changes depending on what angle you're looking at it. And it wasn't disconcerting, but it was kind of shocking how far off like who I thought I was versus like who I am in certain spaces. And like I posted in the thread, it was kind of a thing that I couldn't stop thinking about once I started thinking about it. So for me, I like to hang my hat on the fact that, like, at the core of it all, no matter where I'm at or what scene I put myself in, I still try to be a person of, like, morals and standards. And, I think at its core, that's the one good that, like, I can say I took out of it, that even though my surroundings and my outer presentation might change, at the core of it all, I still try to be that same person through and through, so...
Yeah, I didn't jump in on the thread at all, but like thinking about that now. So I am half Filipino. And while I, like, people know that, I say that, I am like, oh yeah, this is me. I feel like no connection with it at all, which sometimes makes me feel like so strangely guilty that I like don't understand or speak Tagalog. I like don't know how to cook or like veganize any of the food. I have to like look at my little recipes. It's weird because, you know, we do try to, at least for me, know that this is like part of my identity, but also I feel like it's something that I can't claim, if that makes sense. Like, I feel like I have no actual connection to it because I've never been there. Like, yeah, it's interesting because I do feel like even though I am like half white, I look pretty white. Even being in like elementary school, people could tell that I was different, but didn't know what I was, which is the grossest question in the world. But yeah, I feel like even though I wasn't that Filipino, I like those formative experiences made me more white and like want to be more white, if that makes sense. I'm just word diarying, as Cassie so eloquently stated earlier.
Yeah, and to add on to that, I've definitely had my fair share of that as well. I know many of you have heard me speak in the past about, you know, just my roots, being a Cameroonian American, born and raised in the U.S., but, you know, having immigrant parents that immigrated to the U.S., I feel directly connected, but at the same time, I feel distant only because, there's definitely a, there's a nationalist and a culturalist kind of lens to see things through that you don't really see unless you have family from different parts of the world. And, you know, I could be with, you know, aunts and uncles that are very much, you know, from, you know, the country and grew up there, and cousins that, you know, were born there, but then are now going to college and living life here. And there is a difference. I mean, there's still love there and there's still family, but especially the older I get and the more that I represent myself, the less of a past there is. You know, before it used to be, okay, you're the American kid and, you know, we get it. But now it's almost like a playful dismissiveness of like, oh, you just don't know. And that can hurt, because in any other space and place I could go, I could sit here and I could be proud of my African roots, and I can sit here and, you know, not just be proud of it, but actually be able to speak to having a different perspective because of my household and because of places I've gotten to go and food I've gotten to eat and just conversation I got to take part of, because family's family. But then when I'm with family, it becomes this layer of, oh, well, you've only been there once. You went when you were a kid. You don't cook anything. You don't speak to it. Like, you don't, like, you're missing these things. So, you know, the lack of can end up informing the identity. And that's, you know, it's really just left at your feet to decide what to do with it. And I'm still in my process to figure out, you know, what does being Cameroonian American mean to me, even if I could never, you know, re-raise myself there in the first place.
I'm interested. So Seema's analogy of seeing himself like perspective sculpture,
perceptual sculptures,
like perceptual sculpture. Like Lori and Jason, if you're comfortable, I'm curious if you feel like a pressure to act in a different way when you're around relatives who are closer to that heritage, or if you have that exposure where you're with anybody who's closer to that heritage.
Yeah. Yeah, I have plenty, quite a bit. It's almost like you obviously know, like, you're American and there's nothing wrong with that. Obviously we're here, like, you have family that is trying to immigrate here as well. But then there's almost a fear of not being too American. If that, as oddly as that might sound, like, there's a fear of, like, not wanting to come across as if you don't know where you came from. You know, you don't want to just, like, there's a consciousness of not wanting to, you know, accidentally betray your roots, at least in the eyes of the people looking at you. You know, you can't control what they see. You can't control how they come to terms, because especially, you know, when you have immigrant family, there tends to be a terseness in language that you're just like, you just kind of learn to deal with. You know, they'll just kind of, you know, drop a phrase or two on you, just like, ah, you're so, and they're not trying to hurt you. It's just, you know, it's just a difference in rearing. But yeah, like, you just, you want to be able to fit in with your family because it's your family, but, you know, your base is just different. You know, they don't know what it's like to grow up in America. You don't know what it's like to grow up in the proverbial motherland, you know. And it's really what matters more is that, I think in my case, just because, you know, we're at the cusp, because, you know, my generation, you could say, like, my sister and I, and by extension, my brother, even though he was born there, you know, we're the first generation primarily raised in America. So it's not like, you know, you have a two or three other generations after the fact. Like, we're trying to figure this out as a family now. So learning how to navigate that is something that is happening live, because now I have older cousins who immigrated here and they're raising children younger than me. And now and they have to figure out what they're going to do, because some cousins will give them authentic names, and that can make it harder to navigate in America. Some, like myself, have more standard Western names, but then you still have authentic middle names. And it's just like all these cultural exchanges you have to decide to determine how do you want to honor yourself, but also, you know, best engage your new environment. Like, it's tough to have to make the choices, but the choices that because of your position, you end up having to make.
I almost feel it's for me, I know where you're coming from, but when it came to family for me, it was kind of like the family, right? They get on your nerves. You still love them. It is what it is. It was my biggest fear was introducing my family to my American life, if that makes sense. So like my mom has the accent of all accents. Like I understand her clear as day. It's like, I don't have to think about it, but I remember like parent teacher meetings, parent school days. I forgot what they were called, like field day, color day. I'm old. Sorry. And like my mom would show up and it'd just be like, I was definitely afraid that she would open her mouth and say something. And like thinking back on it now, I feel so guilty because it's like, it's my mom. And I guess I was ashamed of who I was because I wanted to fit in and quote unquote conform. So it's like to have my mom there kind of show that side of me that I didn't want people to see because kids are kids, you know, like what they don't understand, they don't understand. So they'll tease you about your accent. They'll tease you about your lunch because your mom made you like African cooking or whatever the case may be. And the one thing that really stood out to me was like, none of the kids in my class were ever really like pushed to try to understand my culture. I can like vividly remember conversations where it's like my teachers would pull me to the side and be like, hey, you should try to like pick up football or go watch a baseball game or something like that. So it was always me having to conform to the general population instead of the general population trying to learn about me. And I think from just like that point of view, that's kind of how I learned to like, I don't say betray my African roots a little bit, but you know, I started to detach from them in order to kind of assimilate into this other world. And yeah, I don't know if that still happens today, Clay. We're all adults now, but I would love to hear the perspective of former teachers if that's still a thing that quote unquote happens.
I don't want to talk in front of you, kind of mentioning teachers here, but I have something I wanted to add to what you were saying about kind of putting your previous kind of heritage aside. So like I'm like first generation, whatever you call it. My parents were born overseas. I was like one of the first in my like family to be born in the States, born and raised here. I've moved around a lot, but still, I've definitely assimilated to like the American lifestyle, to the extent that, you know, I might consider myself white just because that's how, you know, the, you know, census considers me. That's how like, you know, my demographics have kind of put me as, while I kind of like to, assimilate myself with like American culture, as I walk around, as I've gotten older, based on how I look, people don't perceive me as, what, you know, the government perceives me as, you know, people see me as brown, you know, not, you know, not necessarily, you know, what I see as an American, that's what I am first and foremost versus being white, black, brown, tan, whatever you want to call it. So I was definitely raised with this mindset of, hey, I am just an American kid. And then as I got older, kind of came more in college, people kind of perceived me as an ethnic person. So it was definitely difficult for me to kind of come back to that. But then there's another side of this, which is my family. I have a ton of cousins who were born overseas, and they are much closer to our culture and our heritage than I am. So there's this like middle ground that you kind of want to, you kind of jump back and forth back to what you were saying, Seema, about based on who you're around and what society wants of you. One side says, hey, be an American. The other side says, hey, remember your heritage. Remember who we are. So it's, you know, one side of me says, hey, you know, I'm Persian and I have a lot of culture around that I know with my cousins. Another side says, hey, you know, you're an American, try to be an American. There's nothing wrong with doing both, but there is a lot of context switching between both of those.
Yeah. And I would say, I know there's, I know you had the previous person you wanted to reach out to, but yeah, as far as how things are happening today, it's funny. I feel like I've seen quite a few memes in regards to the shift towards you know, Afrocentric teaching and Afrocentric like cultural symbolism. Like you're seeing more black kids, more young black adults in more African patterns and in, you know, with the natural hair and the, and like you're seeing more of that now, but then you'll see memes from, you know, like other children of African immigrants, like, you know, myself or yourself, Seema, where you're like, oh, well, you know, a decade ago, you were making fun of us for this, this, and this. And now all of a sudden it's the wave and you want to get in touch. And it's like, there's a certain level of, you know, bitterness that's, to me, it's well deserved in many respects. But
I think when Black Panther came out, it was probably like the most annoying 2 months of my life, because every time I would go on something, I just roll my eyes at all these people doing the Wakanda Forever. I'm like, 10 years ago, I was an African booty scratcher, right? It's like, hold on now, don't come back here and think it's like shit is all sweet. Excuse my language, but
it's, you put it right as it needs to be put, because it just it's a shame that it has to be that dynamic, but it's real. Like, it's real when you're the one having to live it daily.
Yeah, for sure.
I feel like a mildly similar thing has been happening with, like, white people cooking Asian food and saying it's better than, like, Asian people cooking it. Yeah, it's like, oh, cool. Like, when, you know, you'd bring, like, very fragrant lunches to school, you were like some absolute outcast weirdo, but you know, now, like, let's let this white man hawk spicy chili garlic sauce or something. It's it's like they don't respect or want any of the culture until someone that looks more like them does it, or like it's presented in a more palatable way.
Well, yeah, and I mean, that could, as opposed to letting that take a different turn conversation-wise, I feel like a lot of that has so much to do with, you know, other cultures being treated not just as others, but, you know, almost as trends. You know, it's like it's all just here to entertain the statistical base, and that's it's dehumanizing. And that's just not, it's definitely not what I represent. You know, I'll be damned if I'm here just to entertain someone else. I feel like my personality wouldn't allow that. But that kind of comes back to how you define ourselves, because it extends into a lot of even the politics that we see play out and how people choose to represent themselves. You know, as an American, I think as Ben Franklin put it, you know, I don't always agree with you, but I defend your right to have your opinion. Like, that's like supposed to be a part of the spirit of what it is to be an American. Like, I've seen, you know, Black conservatives, and to me, I look at it and I'm just like, well, hey, look, you know, I may not agree with everything that comes out of your mouth, but you're an American. You have every right to hold that position, you know, and it doesn't mean that there aren't consequences that do come with that. It just means that, hey, you have that space to do that, and I wouldn't want you to feel as if you did. And it's like, you take that, and there's a certain level of freedom that comes with what we talk about in terms of being an American. But when it comes to that identity politic, you're trying to say, well, I am what I am, but this is what I represent, and then I'm going to speak to you about it. It's very difficult to negotiate that room between being something and then you saying what that actually means. Like, you might think you, like me, if I think, okay, so I'm a Black man, so it means X, Y, Z, like, I could think that, and I could mean that, and that into my inner world, that can mean something, but how I walk through the world, that doesn't mean it's how I'm going to be treated, you know? So it's like, it can be a dangerous path when you're talking about having the freedom to represent yourself and be yourself, but then having to then deal with the consequences of what, how you're seen is taken, if that makes sense. Like, you have to, like, be you, but then you also have to recognize where you're at and who you're with.
I feel a lot of what you are all saying, and that combined with the sort of, as a Puerto Rican, I'm by default American, but not really. We're a colony. We, you know, the Taínos were sort of the attempt to assimilate the El Puerto Riqueño to be an American, to the extent that even in the early days, there was a period of time where in Puerto Rico, everything had to be taught in English. No one New English. So it's just, so there's this, I feel so deeply everything that you all have said. And then for me, it's that schizophrenic life between, yeah, I'm an American by default, but I don't feel it when I go home because we are not treated like American citizens in so many respects. And then that's in Puerto Rico, I'm afraid I'm not considered Puerto Rican, even though that's where I live my entire life. And then when I'm here, I'm like, I'm not considered American. And I'm always trying to definitely, with family and friends back home, I present myself differently than I do here, where I'm trying to fit in and be American and be whiter and, you know. So this whole conversation is incredible. I wish it could continue beyond this, because Nigel, this is brilliant. What you're doing, this project is brilliant. Bravo. Makes a lot of us think deeply about a lot of this.
I do have a question for the people who aren't necessarily immigrants, quote unquote. Like, is this something, is it because like you're part of the majority? It's like the, you have the luxury of not thinking about it, of people feeling out of place in society, if that makes sense. Because I always try to like look at things from both sides. The younger me would just kind of be like always angry and like F the world because they didn't get me and I was always treated badly. But then as I've gotten older, I try to like put things in the full perspective. So even though it's not all black and white, like I still try to understand like where the other side is coming from. And like I said about like when kids are kids, like I don't expect a kid to really have like that type of awareness to realize like you may be going to school with someone who doesn't necessarily fit in or who isn't really like part of the culture, right? So I would just, if anyone would want to elaborate on coming from the other side, I'd greatly appreciate that.
Sima, I could say that I had the privilege to think about it, right? Not have it presented to me of where I'm from, right? My father's a first generation Norwegian. Both of his parents immigrated. I was excited when I was in high school to be an exchange student to Sweden. It was close enough. It was the scholarship I got. I got to go over to Norway and meet my relatives, and it felt very exciting. I sort of ignored my mom's side of the family that was Polish and German because for me, for whatever reason, it wasn't as exciting. There was a big family reunion one time, and I went down to Washington and was so excited to meet all of my Norwegian relatives. And they were very politically active in Washington as Republicans. And I felt so alienated that I scrapped the whole thing and never went back. Like for me, it was like, right. It didn't feel that connection. And I have revisited all of the thinking about race and my heritage and everything since Nigel is my son. And I'm feeling inadequate, right, as a white mom. And really think so much about the privilege of being white in a way that I had never had to think about ever before. I'll just leave it at that for now. Really a lot to unpack for me there in many ways.
Yeah, I think what I can say is that somewhere, like I read a description that like being white means you just don't have to think about like race or having like a racial, like it's just a non-thought, like by default. It's not something that you really have to think about. And I feel like that is the best way I've come across for like describing it. So just, I feel like I don't have a race, if that makes sense, because it's default and it's majority. And growing up, one of my closest friends was Indian American. And, you know, she brought like the lunches to school, right, that people thought were weird. And of course, now like Indian food is very cool. But I think even like when I think back on it now, I felt like there was still so much that I was oblivious to about her experience that like we didn't talk about until, you know, she went to New York for school and like was able to join like an Indian sorority and like meet a whole bunch of other like Indian Americans for her, which was just like mind blowing. And for me, it was like, oh, wow. Like, I don't think I realized how tough it was for her, you know, until she left. And then like, that kind of opened up the space for her to have conversations about it, I guess. And it was, yeah, it was really like eye-opening for me because I was like, oh, wow. Like I was really just completely unaware, right, of this entire like facet of her experience and the way that she struggled with it. It's, yeah, I think there's a lot of obliviousness, maybe like willful ignorance even.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of that can be, you know, in some sense you could say, I mean, it's, you could say it's taught, but then in a lot of ways it just really, the better word may be that it's normalized. You know, so like in a lot of ways, like when I see, like I have, you know, Black peers that just have, you know, raw angst for really anyone white. You know, there's just a, you know, they've been in the classes, they've seen experiences in their own lives, like they have the vernacular to speak to, you know, the systemic reign of terror that's come down upon Black people and the Black community by the hand of, you know, many a white hand. But I also know too, there's a reality that in terms of the discourse between, you know, the many stakeholders when it comes to race in America, that there are plenty of, you know, white people who just didn't really have a chance to do or think any different. And it's not to, you know, take any given white person all the way off the hook, but it's to say that, hey, look, if we really want a solution, if we really want to get to a place where this works for everyone, then let's focus on getting there, as opposed to it being a pure, you know, retribution play or a pure, you know, tit for tat type of thing. It's like, okay, if there is anger to be had and to be expressed, you know, there is a sense of righting wrongs that does need to be had, but there also still needs to be something that's built. There still needs to be something that can last. There still needs to be something that is sustained, and there has to be understanding on all sides to have that. So it can't just be an extreme of one to rectify the extreme of another. There needs to be a balance that's had. So yeah. So I mean, in a lot of ways, I don't, you know, blame a given white person for thinking how they've thought or experiencing how they've experienced, because it's a generational thing. Like, it's, you have parents that weren't taught to question things, grandparents that weren't taught to question things. Like, it's a compound interest upon decisions made long ago that you wouldn't even think twice about. But that doesn't change the fact that things do need to change. Things do need to be done differently, and rights, you know, we need to be further entrenched and established.
So can I pose this question? With us being, I guess you call us first generation of whatever it is that we are. If hypothetically, when we all have children one day, right? Should it be on us as the parents, first generations, to try to like empower our kids to not feel shame of the other side of their heritage? Or should it be more of a, once again, I'm going back to this majority example, for other kids to go out and want to learn more about different cultures / heritage? I think it was the third question I posed in that like thread. It was kind of along the lines of, you know, is there more I can do? Whether that's like not just have a conversation and forget about it, maybe go do research about where you're from, go do research about Persia, the type of food they eat, history, something like that. Something that shows the other person that like I'm more invested in who they are as a person outside of a random conversation, you know? And I think that's the thing I struggle with, because I can see it from both sides, and I don't know what side needs to make that happen in order for us to get to this perfect world we're trying to achieve, if I call it that.
I mean, you can make a case and say that it's it's simply needed all around. I mean, if we've learned anything in a given history class or a given civilization class, you know that, cultural exchange is a part of human interaction and civilization and empire building. It can go very wrong in many instances in history, but there's a lot that's come to be because groups of people intermingled. And I think that now we can do that on a digital level by learning information and discussing findings. Unfortunately, because of the digital landscape, we're in a position where we have extremes and people tend to stick to their familiar extremes, but the resources are there to find and learn more and to discuss, all across without even having to leave your home. And simultaneously, as far as a person on a personal level, I absolutely, Lord willing, my parents will be able to, meet, greet, and connect with all their grandchildren. And, they'll have more of an opportunity to, directly exchange what our culture is to us with them. And in the meantime, I'll have to do a better job of understanding what my culture means to them so that I can figure out what that means to myself, so that I can articulate it to them as opposed to hoping that someone else could do it for me. So it's work on all ends, but it's the collaboration and the exchange that matters. It has to happen civilly. It has to happen with respect. It has to happen in an informed manner, but not in a presumptive informed matter where you read a couple articles and now you think you know a whole culture. It's more of a, hey, this is what I've learned. Can you help elaborate? This is what I've learned. This is how I'm speaking on it. Is there anything I'm missing? Have I misunderstood? It has to be more of a, less you trying to drive the conversation with you at the wheel of another car, essentially another culture, and more of a, hey, am I driving this right? Or, hey, I'm watching you, is there something that I'm not getting? You need to be teachable still, even in the midst of learning and attempting to experience.
Well, I'm going to call someone out for a comment that was made. She might not like me for it, but I think Grace referred to that as being the walking encyclopedia. So I'm curious. I'm curious what she thinks on that.
So the difference between being, the resident expert and being the walking encyclopedia, the difference between that and what Jason just described is the communication. So what Jason described was person A met person B. They were from different cultures. They went their separate ways and learned about each other's cultures and came back and had a conversation. And a conversation that said, hey, I read this, or I did some research and I learned this information. It was interesting to me, or it wasn't interesting to me, but I'd like to have a conversation about it. As opposed to person A meets person B, they come from different cultures, and they say, hey, that's really interesting. Tell me all about Cameroon. No, I don't want to be... you literally have a world of information at your fingertips. I don't need to be the expert. You can go out and read a book or read an article and come back and engage with me, and we can have a conversation where you might go ahead and ask me questions. Yes, but you've come to the table with something, not with just the simple expectation that I am going to be that person for you and answer all of those questions. I don't want to be that person for you.
Right. And you also don't want to tokenize or act reductively towards another culture. Even at work, I'm an alum now, but a VFA alum, and I talk to Yuzika quite a bit. And I know one of the times where I have talked to her, I was like, hey, look, I love anime. I appreciate Japanese culture. It's fun. It's entertaining. But let me know if my enjoyment of it or my recollections of it ever somehow inexplicably cross a line, because I would never be one to say that, hey, that in and of itself, that medium is the entire culture. And thankfully, I know better than to think that. But I can at least, you know, pick up on themes within it, pick up on different motifs. And then I can go to her and ask her about that and how those specific themes and motifs, how they resonate since she's the one coming from the culture, you know, things like that. Like, it's one thing to tokenize and it's another thing to discuss.
Right. Like, I don't want to be your Barbadian friend. I want to be your friend who happens to be from Barbados. You know what I mean? Like, as far as, and I mentioned that specifically because you used the term token, and that's something that has been an issue for, you know, a long time. Not for, I'm not saying for me specifically, but just in general. Like, we, I mean, there was literally a character on South Park whose name was Token. Like, it's what happens, right? And I just don't feel that as an individual who is different from someone else, that I should be held responsible for their, for all of their knowledge of, you know, my background, whatever part of my background that is. Whether it's like, I know we're talking about our like nationalities and cultural backgrounds, but whatever my background is, if I have a background as a performer, I should not be the only place that you go to get information about performing. You have other resources. So just to draw that parallel.
So one thing that kind of circle back to like your third question, Seema, I think is, representation really matters. I think we need more kinds of stories, but we also need to not like tokenize the stories themselves. Because sometimes there's like the ethnic film that's like completely authentic, but it's not actually, it's like held up as the exception. And as a parent, one of the, we read a book together called Measuring Up. It's about a Taiwanese young, it's a comic book, graphic novel about a young girl who moves to the US from Taiwan. But she's entering into a cooking contest to try to get Flyer grandmother over. And it definitely goes into like the stereotypes she faces as like an Asian American in the United States, and the scene of lunch and her not wanting to have Taiwanese food, like wanting American food, is in there. But what's really kind of is, it's about like the, what I found like really beautiful about it is that it's about the interplay between cultures. I think that, you know, it was a really good book for us to read together, and discuss, because, there were some touchstones that my daughter could connect with, that then were like stepping stones to like think about it, another person's experience, in a different way.
Yeah, I guess I kind of put my own experiences on others. Like, in my experiences, I really sometimes want to be left alone when it comes to like the immigrant thing. So I don't want someone asking me about Liberian cooking, what's it like to eat fufu? And it's like, I don't care. I'm not in the mood for it. So I kind of take that into my own life, where it's like, I have very, I'm just call them surface level, but very like surface level conversations. And after they're done, that's it. And I think since this, I've kind of like asked myself, you know, what, how can I change the problem that I'm stating here, right? Because I don't, I think it's naive to think that it's like everyone else's problem and there's nothing you can do to try to fix it. So I appreciate the advice, Jason, Grace, of the context in which you asked those questions. Something I could definitely definitely take to heart and keep in mind going forward. So,
yeah, and not being afraid to command that respect. You know, like I think that just to add on to it, I know I've offline, I've made the point to people, and I've heard it made before that, you know, even for something as simple as, you know, a person's name, you know, I remember I was in a high school enrichment program and we were working on a graduation ceremony, and I was trying to get the announcer to pronounce my middle name correctly. And like, he just kept butchering it and just like almost jokingly butchering it. And like, people were laughing, but to me, it wasn't a laughing matter. Like, that's, it's my name. Like, it's not a joke. It's my name. And, you know, you want people to respect that, but they're not always going to know to. So even if to them it's a lighthearted moment, like, you got to be very willing to just set people straight and just let them know. Like, there's, you know, because I've seen even, you know, powerful people. Like, I've heard many a distinguished, powerful person still refer to Africa as a country. Like, it's just one of those things where, because it resonates so personally, that, you know, you could be, you know, the president or whatever. Like, I have no problem stopping you and saying, no, that's not accurate. And funny enough, that's actually something that parallels to my experience at the at West Point, where one of the things that they told us was that, you know, anyone at any level is allowed to make a uniform correction to anyone. So if a 4-star general, for whatever reason, has an error in their uniform, I, back then as a cadet, could just say, you know, sir, I would like to, like, sorry to, you know, take your time, but I would like to, you know, correct you on, you know, such and such on your uniform. And if they see it and they fix it, then, you know, they appreciate it, or at least they should. But, you know, that's dicey. But it's a point of just saying that, hey, look, there are things that matter more than, you know, what, there's things that matter beyond your own perception. There are things that matter simply because they matter. And there are things that are due respect when met. And that includes culture, that includes the tenets of that culture. And if you're not in a position to understand it, then seek that out, as opposed to feeling entitled to an explanation of what you find yourself ignorant.
Thank you to you, because I to all of who contributed, because I find myself always not wanting to, like, or maybe too exhausted. The whole thing where Puerto Rico should be a state. Hello? What about, you know, autonomy? What about us given the chance to figure that out by ourselves? Like, well, haven't you done that many times? Like, no, not really. So, and I never know, it's sort of like Grace's encyclopedia. I'm not an encyclopedia on the history of colonialism in Puerto Rico, and let me, you know, let me just explain that to you. Do you have, you know, a month? And so this whole conversation has brought out so much.
So do you feel like that, by correcting people on things that you think should be corrected, does it make the situation better? Does it kind of add strain to it now, where there's kind of this like unspoken tension because you've kind of checked it at the door? And now, because I've been through this, you know, other companies I worked with, I correct someone on my name, then they kind of give you that little like cringy look, and they don't even know that they're doing it, but it's just like, ew. And
I mean, like, my name is my, it's my, it's like Jason said, like, this is my name. And people, I mean, okay. So from a cultural perspective, people, like, first of all, names have meaning, right? That, and I'm going to start there with names have meaning. And a woman gets pregnant and she knows the name that she wants to give to her child. And if she doesn't know, she puts great thought into it. She doesn't just like, you know, randomly say, oh, you know what? John, good. We're done here. No, like people take the time. There's a reason why there are books and websites and so many resources that people like take the time to go through and comb through and say, I want my child to have this name because it means, you know? So as far as checking people at the door, I'm not really concerned with how you feel about me checking you. This is me personally. I'm not concerned about how you feel about me checking you. The fact is, I demand respect. I deserve to be respected. I shouldn't have to ask for your respect, but I am asking for your respect, even if it's just in pronouncing my name the right way. I had a professor who called me Gras, and I understood that he came from a different cultural background, French African. Cool, fine. That's how you would pronounce this word where you are from. But this is my name, and my name is Grace. And I expect that you will call me Grace the same way you expect that I will call you Professor, not AO.
Yeah, it's boundaries, you know, because I've told people before, like, you know, we learn over time, like, you learn how to say and spell Krzyzewski,
Tchaikovsky, Dostoevsky. You can get through all of those, but you can't say.
Right. All of a sudden, you know, it's Simatude, all of a sudden, that's hard. You know, all of a sudden, you know, Ndamukong, all of a sudden, that's hard, and you don't want to do it, and you just want to shorthand. It's like, no, like.
Like, do you have a nickname for that? Can I just call you C? No, my name is Sima.
Right, like, it's just put in the legwork. Like, it's one thing if you're trying, like, if you're practicing and you're trying and you're asking for proper pronunciation, that's one thing, because that shows that you respect the source material. Like, you respect that. Like, imagine, like, you're making music and you just snatch a clip and you think you should be able to just make your track. No, like, you got to pay royalties. Like, there's someone who actually owns that, who you need to pay respect because of what you're using it for, as opposed to just taking it because you think you should take it. Like, no, like, my name is my name because it's my name. And I know full and well, if I mispronounce your name, you would correct me. You know, just because it's not normal for you doesn't mean you're beyond correction. And correction doesn't even have to be super harsh. It's simply, I expect to be paid the respect that anyone would expect to be paid. And if we have to take baby steps to get there, then we'll take it. That's fine. If that's what you need, then that's fine. I shouldn't have to feel bad about being paid the respect that any other person would be paid in as innocuous of a moment as knowing what my name is.
Well, even like the example of the name, it kind of like, it wasn't until I was older and like I got into the professional world that the things really started to annoy me about like having to correct people. And like I was saying, people would oftentimes kind of like cringe at me. And then there'd be this awkward tension where it's like, great, it's my first week here. I got three people already hate me. And now I kind of have to like navigate this world where I'm always on, I don't want to say on edge, but like people are hoping for me to fail, right? They're waiting for my downfall because I was the guy who checked it at the door. And oftentimes I start internalizing that like over time is like, if it's a repeated pattern, then I must be the problem. You know what I mean? Like everywhere I go, if people are starting to like avoid me because I'm doing what feels right to me, it's like, sooner or later, human nature is just to start to like look towards yourself and be like, am I really the problem? And start second guessing yourself, which I think is one of my biggest problems. People think like, excuse my language, like I'm an asshole. But if you really knew me, I'm not. I'm just the type of person who like, I give it to you straight and then we move on. And how you take it is how you take it, right? Like, I've never gone out of my way to disrespect someone or try to be mean or condescending. But oftentimes people kind of treated me as if I was the problem, like this negative energy going throughout the world because, like you said, I was looking for that respect. And so I just stopped, you know? I just stopped trying and just went along with it because my own mental sanity, I couldn't keep up. because I felt like sooner or later it was going to be me against the world. And that was a battle that, one, I wasn't really willing to fight, and two, I thought I was going to lose. So.
Right. And I mean, you're not, and you're definitely not the first person to go through it. I will let you say that I sense no asshole energy here. It's certainly not a company that, you know, necessarily entertains that for very long. Just know that, you know, having a sense of what you can control and having a sense of, you know, what consequences can come from what, I mean, just, I know I said what I said about representing yourself and what you believe about yourself, but also I had mentioned being able to kind of tape and measure, you know, consequences external to yourself. And yeah, I mean, there are companies that, you know, you'd correct them on your name, especially if you expect your name to be pronounced fully, because that's what you've been called your whole life, especially by those closest to you. And, you know, they'd make your life hell because you are pushing some non-Eurocentric standard on them. And they don't expect you to be the type to bite back. In fact, they probably hired you because they thought you'd comply. Like, you know, it's all this stuff that's just out of your control that it's like, just from me to you, I'm letting you know that you don't have to shoulder that like that. And I would never want to see you have to shoulder that like that, because you clearly have more to offer beyond a needless burden like that. So just know that from me to you. But yeah, of course. But I would just say, just knowing that your environment, no, I appreciate you, Grace. Just knowing that, you know, your environment is one that does play a hand in it and what you show. But just know that that's not, don't make that your burden if it doesn't have to. But also, you know, measure the consequences. So if it means, all right, well, just like, don't compromise yourself. Don't think that, oh, man, like, I'm wrong for going by my whole name. Think, OK, well, is this the hill I want to die on? Maybe not in my first week. Fine. It's SEMA. Like, just, you know, kind of things like that, where it's like, it's the little wins. Like, you know, you got to like win each front of the war, you know, to win the whole war. Like, you know, you may not get it all, you know, you get the battles, but then you don't want to lose the war type of thing. Like, you, like, yes, you got to, you know, you have to, you know, still command your respect, like, still at least put that out there forwardly, but don't think that you have to be the one who gives way just because there's an entire group of people that, you know, has never thought to pay that kind of respect. Like, you're not, like, I don't ever want you to feel as if you're wrong for commanding that respect. You're not. Like, if how your environment takes it is how they'll take it, but you yourself are not wrong for commanding that type of respect.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I never really felt as, like, if I was wrong. I kind of felt more of like I was a common denominator. So obviously it was something with me, and, you know, life happens. You have responsibilities, bills, loans, whatever the case may be, where you kind of have to like start making sacrifices, and you either kind of go along to get along because there's a greater, I call it greater good, or there's a greater goal that you're trying to reach. Or it's like you said, you can die on this hill, and then it's like the unknowns with dying on that hill, I think sometimes are super scary. And I'll go out on a limb and say, like, until I actually started experiencing that in life, I never really figured out, like, and even now I didn't really know until my girlfriend pointed it out to me, but that's what women deal with on a daily basis. It's just like living in a man's world. After a while, you just get so full, fed up with the bullshit. You kind of go along with it and keep your mouth shut, and you keep your head down, your hoodie on. And yeah, it wasn't until like she made that parallel for me that I really realized that like there's so much of it in the world, and I don't know. So now like I try to ask myself, you know, I don't try to complain about it as much. I try to ask myself, how can I be better? So yeah, that's why to give you background on why I asked that third question of what I could do to try to be better. So.
That's the whole name thing is just like the most infuriating thing that can happen. Like, even if you have a name that's easy to pronounce, it can, people just like butcher it.
Yeah, but I'd say, hey, look, if they need baby steps, give them baby steps. Like, I enunciate, you know, I do syllables, you know, I draw diagrams, you know, I draw pictures, you know, I do the whole thing, because if people need to be baby, then fine. Like, I'm gonna meet you where you're at, you know, because it matters. Like, it's just one of those ones where it matters because it matters. You know, people aren't always going to get it right the first time. I don't necessarily expect them to, but if they need that little, you know, facetious pat on the butt of encouragement, then by all means, like, take it step by step with them. And if they're especially indignant, then, you know, let it be, honestly, because some people do just don't want to put in the legwork to understand other cultures. And that's it's on them.
This is like such an interesting topic for me because I think most of you on the Zoom call know that I'm having a baby. And I've been so back and forth about his last name. And I'm like, do I really want to give him the life that I've had where I have to like spell it and pronounce it, and it's just like a pain and like, it has nothing. It doesn't sound like potato. Like, please stop. Like, do I really want to saddle him with that? But it's like, yeah, I kind of do. Cause like, what if there's no other, like, what if nobody else is going to pass on the name? Like, my brother has a kid, but she doesn't have the last name. So I think this conversation has made me come around to, yes, he's going to have to deal with the consequences of this last name because it is important.
This is something I saw on an internet discussion, but it was a thread about women talking about like changing their names. And one of them posted, maybe this is relevant, but saying that she was sad that she had changed her name when she got married because she felt like it was a marker of her Jewish identity. And with it gone, that was like a way she couldn't connect with people, like at least immediately when they learned, you know, like what her name was. I think that like, that's a good decision.
Yeah. He might get both last names, but mine is, it's staying on there. Yeah. We're keeping a parentado in the family.
So he's got a problem. He can give him Jason's number.
Potato, Lori? Really? You've been asked that? Lori Potato?
A potato. It's like, no. Like, it's really not hard. Just like, just give it a shot. I'll correct you and it'll be fine. But yeah, like school was so weird. Making doctor's appointments is weird. And I'm just like, do I want to do that? And I'm like, yeah, I think it's important.
Yeah, I agree. Mine is Condoleezzi. So I'm white, but my family, my grandfather's first generation Italian. And when we got married, we wanted to hyphenate because same thing. We wanted to keep both names. I knew people when I was young who had hyphenated names, but I didn't realize that like signing up for websites and credit cards can't recognize a hyphenated name, and your bank accounts, you can't have a hyphenated name. So the two names are just smushed together. And then in the LGBTQ community, it's not just about names, but it's also pronouns, getting people to think or to call you they or them. Or we have people in our choir who go by she, but to look at them, they don't match what you in your head would think somebody who uses a pronoun of she should look like. So that's kind of a thing. And then back to the original question, in terms of being your true self and not, we built a house. I think most of you know that. And we know where we live in the country-esque part of Delaware that we can't always tell people that we are a same-sex couple. But a lot of the contractors have trucks that have, you know, pickup trucks that have bumper stickers of people's names that we don't necessarily agree with. And one day when we came to look at the house over the summer, somebody had taken a can of spray paint and wrote Trump on the beams of our garage before they drywalled. So of course we went to the office and complained, and there's a good sign, a big deal. But what that name signifies to a person who is of color or LGBTQ or not cisgender, heterosexual, white, is it's triggering, and to not be able to feel safe in now your own home because we have contractors in the other day, and it ended up being, it was the same person who had the Trump truck, was just all in the house. And I had to leave my office area where I have, you know, pictures of Daniel and me and, you know, a little book of Celine Dion and gay love things. It's just not being able to feel safe and comfortable in my own home. I am a white male. I get that, but I understand what it's like to not feel safe. And I can't imagine, I can quote unquote turn off being gay if I needed to, or just not talking about it or not speaking. But if you are a person of color, you can't turn that off. You can't hide that. You can't put that away. I feel good that we are finally to a place where a person who is of color can walk around with a mask and people not be scared, because we're all in masks because it's a damn pandemic. But yeah, I think that the we still have a long way to go. And that's all I wanted to share.
Yeah, I think the respect for different people's consequences for being who they are is still not nearly high enough. You know, there are things that, you know, like Anthony stated, as a gay man in America, but in where he's living with his partner, as well as for myself as a Black man in America, or, you know, even for, you know, Lori or Cassie as women of color, like it's, there are consequences that unfortunately get brought upon our doorsteps. I mean, that, if anything, that makes me think about, you know, LeBron of all people, even though this happened while he was in at an LA home, in Brentwood, which, funny enough, my sister actually went to a private school in this very fancy LA neighborhood, and someone had broken in and, you know, wrote nigger on his gate. And you would think that that's insane that that would even happen. I mean, granted, it happened to a man with a second home, sure. And it happened to a man who's rather famous on this earth, sure. But to think that even, like, to me, my first thought was, even as much of an anomaly as he is as a person, everything involved, the fact that even someone like him could still not escape that, like, it lets me know that there's really, as things currently stand, you know, hardly a chance that any of us could escape it. You know, like, there's no amount of money I could earn, no amount of acclaim for professional and personal feats that could make me escape the fact that, yes, I am a Black man in America, and there are people who feel entitled to belittle me. There are people who feel the need to belittle those in the LGBTQ community. There are people who feel the need to belittle women, just anyone who's not them. And even amongst, you know, other white men, like, there are richer white men who want to belittle poor white men and, you know, extract them for votes every 4 years. You know, like, it's just all these things. And it's just like, if things can't be civil, then we're going to end up with more extremes, and more extremes beget, you know, more extreme results.
So that leads me to an interesting point I was thinking of, right? Like, the people who belittle others, is it for, like, some personal gain, or is it just like to motivate or to make themselves feel better? Because the way I look at it is, like, there's enough shit going on in the world that, like, I don't have the time to belittle other people. You know what I mean? Like, I ain't got time for that. I got too much going on, full-time job, two dogs, a significant, you know what I mean? It's just like, so unless you, and I think, like, unless you really have, like, nothing worth, I don't say living for in life, but, like, nothing of substance in your life that, like, really grabs your attention, is that why people in, like, rural America, and I can't speak to this because I've never been to rural America, but is that why they kind of act the way they do? It's like, there's nothing else for them, right? That makes sense?
I mean, just from what I've come to understand, and of course, you know, I can stand to be corrected since that's not my experience. You know, obviously, having spoken on being Black, but also speaking as someone born and raised in a large city. You know, I was actually just reading a quote, you know, yesterday, where it was essentially saying that, you know, a person in that circumstance, you know, even when in, you know, that, I won't say a low of a circumstance, but I'll say, like, a socioeconomically low of a circumstance, even as a white person, you know, if you pretty much the quote was saying that, like, if you give them a glimmer of a hope that they're better than the best of another person from another race, or someone who has more than them but is of another race, then you're essentially giving them a lifeline of some sort to say, well, hey, I can give you something that they couldn't have still. Like, okay, yeah, like, they're who they are, but, like, they're not white. You know, like, it's like kind of giving you that thing to say, hey, well, you know what, I can, if you roll with me, if you vote for me, if you do this with me, then I'll take care of you. Don't worry, because you have something that is of permanence that they could never have, type of thing. Like, you're kind of selling a dream that you know you're not going to deliver on. And that kind of leans into, like, my point about, you know, leverage. I think on a political level, you know, we're seeing people leverage that type of thought and leveraging it into votes, leveraging it into policy, leveraging it into really their own agendas. Like, it's not even to serve the people they're getting the votes from. It's just to, you know, maintain their positions in order to enact their policies, to maintain their salaries, to maintain their assets, to maintain their legacies. Like, it's very much a self-serving position to be in, but it's self-serving for a very select few that pits a lot of, you know, the, not to call us laymen, but, you know, in terms of power and leverage, the lay person, pitting them against each other. I mean, I've quite honestly, even though there are better discussions that need to be had in terms of race, and there's significant improvements that are needed in terms of race relations, you know, the way I put it simply is that somewhere out there in the midst of people arguing over race and gender and sexual orientation and all the different classes, you know, there's a white guy making money off of it. You know, like, yeah. You know, all these platforms, all these arguments, all this attention, you know, you can make video after video on YouTube, but, you know, there's a group of people somewhere making money off the attention in the ad space. Same with TV, same with all the apps. Like, it feeds into itself, unfortunately. And even with the conversations, if they were more civil, it would solve the need. And if you solve the need, you have less need for business. And if there's less business, there's less revenue. And if there's less revenue, there's less profit. And with less profit, there's less power. Like, it all kind of feeds into itself still. So as much as we have these conversations and these struggles and all these things, the game within the game is that someone's profiting off of it. Someone's leveraging it, and someone's helping themselves with it.
I mean, for 50 plus years though, come on, like, I'll fly out there and we can have a conversation. Like, if your life hasn't changed after 50 years, it's like, clearly at some point you have to, like, stop and ask yourself, something needs to change, right? I would assume. I can't speak for other people, but.
I mean, if you're a pawn on a chessboard, you don't really ask questions, you just move forward.
So you think these people are, like, reiterating not their own beliefs, but the beliefs that someone in propaganda has given them, is what you're saying?
Ah, you're starting to catch along. All right.
One thing I've seen with being around college students, especially in Iowa, when the language first kind of started coming out around privilege, and like taking ownership of your own privilege and recognizing that, there was the pushback that I saw was always like, I'm not privileged. Like, my parents did, none of my parents like made money, or like, I'm not privileged because of whatever. I think a lot of that is driven by, there's really a culture of shame that we really don't build. We have very few places, I think, in our culture where we build kind of positivity and worthiness. And so it creates like this scarcity for self-worth. And one of the civil rights movement, one of the negative consequences of it was that like, racism went underground. It made it so that being a racist was understood as, this is the wrong thing to do, but it still didn't spark that self-reflection. And so people went along with these racist views without like understanding that there were racist views, and at the same time being like very offended if they were called a racist. I think that's partly what has to change to get more.
I think that relates to, like, this past year, the whole thing, I'm trying to think of, like, a better way to put it, but anybody who lives in Philly, they've been calling them gravy seals. Like, the guys who are really upset about the Columbus statue and, you know, everything that happened around Columbus Day and the riots. And, you know, my family's very, like, off the boat Italian. And so my dad is one of those people who's like, we fought really hard for Columbus Day. We're not giving this up, because he doesn't view it as, like, it's about Columbus. He views it as, this is a thing the Italian immigrants fought for to get respect. And so I think the thing that a lot of times those groups of people who've been in the United States longer forget is that just because you had to fight to get something doesn't mean everybody else should have to fight just as hard to get something. That doesn't lessen, you know, progress that your group has made to help other people and to be more caring and more thoughtful than the generation before you. And, you know, I think that's one of those things, like, Sean, when you said it, moving it underground, like, I feel like it's a thing that's talked about in Italian circles or talked about in certain circles, right? But, like, it didn't really become very public, from what I could see, until this year, because of the zeitgeist of everything that was happening and going on. And so all these people who had these thoughts were getting called out for being racist. But they were very offended that you were calling them racist, because they felt like what they were doing was actually their justification of other people being racist against them. It was like this giant cycle of weird, negative, bad feelings that have been going on for so long. And I think I'm encouraged by all the open discourse that everyone's having, because I think it causes people to really think. Like, when you say something out loud, it's different than if you have to say it in your head or if you have to say it in an echo chamber. And, you know, maybe that's not happening as much in those rural communities, because there's just not as much discourse. Maybe that's not happening as much in those communities where it's more homogenized, or we've set it up to be really siloed in a certain way. But I don't think it's as simple as, like, we look at it and say this group is ignorant or this group is racist. I think it's more this group has internalized the feeling that they have been discriminated against, even if they haven't, like, systemically before them have been. And that gets really complicated, because then they're projecting feelings onto other people who are really just trying to have the same goal, right? Like, everybody wants to be loved. Everybody wants to be respected. Everybody wants to be heard. But telling other people no isn't the best way to do that, if that makes sense. And as it's coming out, I'm hearing word diarrhea again out of my mouth. But, like, you know, I think what I'm trying to say is, I think it's America is such a racist place and has been for so long, that so many different groups are tied up in this systemic racism in a way that so many people don't even realize what they're doing is terrible, because they think what they're doing is right. And that's being exploited politically. And we've definitely seen that in the last year.
So I kind of had a different view on it, right? So when was it 2016 that, was it 2016 that Trump came in office?
Yes.
Yeah, 2016. I kind of felt it was like, after everything went down and you had kind of time to decompress, I started doing, like, I really wanted to understand why. And, like, the simple answer would be, like, there's racists in America who don't want to see the structure of white male dominance leave. Okay, great. But then I was like, okay, there's only so many white males in this country, right, that makes up the X amount of people that we consider the United States of America. And then one of my friends kind of turned me to this podcast, and I can't remember the name. I'll be happy to share it afterwards. But they're kind of saying, like, after the election, they went around and they asked people in, like, the rural Ohios and the Iowas and the Dakotas, like, why did you vote for Trump? And a lot of them kind of said, like, they felt like they had been forgotten about in politics, right? And so Trump was, I guess, something new, which I really, when I thought about it, I couldn't be mad at. And it got me thinking, like, should it be on us as people? I don't want to call us, like, advanced or more civilized or more cultured, whatever you want to say, like, coastal people, to try to go into those rural areas and understand them? Or should it be on them to come out, to leave their silos, as you call it, right? And I think it goes back to my earlier point of, like, should it be on me to find out more about you, or should I wait for you to kind of give me what you want me to know about you?
I think it should be more of, like, a mix. Like, it's going to be hard if you know something about someone, but they don't know anything about you.
Or going to a doctor as a small kid. You don't know the person and you're scared. Somehow, we have to find trust in each other, some common ground. I have a section on my website called The Reason, and all I know, I want to be on that list. The list is of people of color who were killed in this country by police. So I have to do something about it. I have to start making people understand that they aren't different from someone just because of the difference in skin color or race or religion. My website says that to see beyond someone's skin color, you also have to be able to see beyond their politics and to try to understand them. Seema, thanks so much for bringing this conversation to the group. What was it like being so open with your colleagues?
To be honest with you, it was kind of liberating because this is the first time I've been able to express who I am. And not only from being a person of color, but just also just being a person who I felt like could show that he goes through personal struggles and that he has a life about himself that isn't always perfect, you know? To answer your question simply, it was liberating. It was a feeling that I've never really gotten before. I think Stratus has kind of bred the culture of where you can be open about your feelings and no one's going to be there to judge you, or it's not going to make for an awkward conversation or put people in awkward positions. And that's something I appreciate about working at Stratus. To go take it a little bit deeper, it was a little bit nerve-wracking, you know. Obviously, you put yourself out there in any situation, you don't know how people are going to react, how people are going to receive it. But I was happy that I resonated with some people, you know. I think just the whole discussion we were having, as you kind of went deeper and deeper into it, it was liberating to kind of get things off your chest and hear people say what you've been feeling. But oftentimes you don't know how to put into words yourself, because I think it's so much to unpack. And so hearing people kind of describe what it is you were feeling and how it is you were feeling kind of allows you to not have to always be the person who has to, I don't want to say put it into words, but that's the best way I can explain it, put it into words. Because not every feeling is culpable of putting into words. And I think, you know, to have people with Stratus who feel the same way you do, who have the empathy, who have the experiences behind them to really understand what it is to be just a person in this world. I don't want to say a person of color or a black person, whatever the case may be, but just be a person in this world and understand the hardships that come with it. It's something that I truly value. And if I was to be honest, something I'll probably take with me for a long time, you know. Sets the bar high as far as like producing a work culture where people truly feel included. So I really did appreciate that.
I'm so glad you shared this story with me. Thanks again, Seema. I really hope you can help me continue my project. I'll always try my best to be there as a friend if you need one. This was Seema Torbeau and the IDEA team at Stratus. I'm Nigel Uzi from See Beyond My Skin. Stay strong and stay true to your story.